Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the elections in Sweden, the results of which many find alarming, though not as dire as some predicted, with the far-right Sweden Democrats gaining 17.6% of the vote to the once-dominant centre-left Social Democrats' 28%, their worst showing in decades. Sherry Berman, a professor of political science at Barnard College of Columbia University and author of the forthcoming book, Democracy and Dictatorship, From the Ancien Regime to the Present Day, joins us. An expert on European history and politics, she will analyze why across Western Europe, long-ruling social democratic parties are in eclipse while far-right populism is on the rise. We'll discuss how much the far-right, pro-Russia, anti-immigrant and anti-EU Sweden Democrats profited from the lack of a narrative from the centre and the left while they were able to demonise Muslims and immigrants without offering solutions. And with Italy embracing far-right populism as Germany's AfD challenges Merkel and Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic drift further into neo-fascism, xenophobia and white nationalism, we will assess the overall picture of radical politics filling the vacuum left by sclerotic socialists who fail to defend the EU and its values and build on its success while offering no alternative narrative to Trump-like demagoguery. Then we'll assess the move by the Trump administration to close down the Palestinian mission in Washington, while National Security Advisor John Bolton cites Palestinian efforts to prosecute Israelis for alleged violations of international law and the mistreatment of noncombatants in threatening American judges and lawyers working with the International Criminal Court. Khaled El-Gindi, a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, who was an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations, joins us to discuss how under Trump the U.S. has taken such a pro-Netanyahu stance that it doesn't even pretend anymore to be an honest broker between the Israelis and Palestinians. Then finally, we will speak with Richard Clark, who served three consecutive presidents as Special Assistant to the President for Global Affairs, National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism, and Special Advisor to the President for Cyberspace, whose latest book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. He joins us to discuss the probability of Russian cyber meddling in the November elections and the unprecedented dangers of having such a reckless and compromised president who is acting more like a tool of a foreign power than a defender of democracy. And joining us now is Sherry Berman, a professor of political science at Barnard College of Columbia University, whose research interests include European history and politics, the development of democracy, populism and fascism, and the history of the left. Her forthcoming book is Democracy and Dictatorship, From the Ancien Regime to the Present Day. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sherry Berman.
Glad to be here.
And what's your verdict here, Sherry, in terms of obviously the far right did well in Sweden, but not as some alarmists predicted, and the Social Democrats have been in eclipse. They've dominated Swedish politics for almost 100 years. And who's going to form a government? It seems like a standoff.
Well, it is a standoff. It's not possible for either the traditional parties of the left, led by the Social Democrats, nor the traditional parties of the right, led by the largest right party called the Moderates, to form a majority government now that the Sweden Democrats, the populists, have almost 18% of the vote. So probably what you're going to get is a minority government, although it is possible that, unlike in the past, the center-right parties will find the temptation to rely on the populists too great to resist, in which case you would get a center-right government, but one that depends on the populists, thereby giving them an awful lot of influence over policymaking, particularly on the issues they care most strongly about, namely immigration, migration, asylum policy, etc.
But the Conservatives vowed prior to the election not to form a government with the far-right Sweden Democrats.
That is correct, and Sweden is unlike many other European countries in that all the traditional parties have thus far refused to form coalitions with the Sweden Democrats. However, there is the option of the traditional right parties forming a minority government and then depending on the Sweden Democrats to pass policy. That seems increasingly likely as a possibility, simply because, as I said, otherwise a majority government is not possible. And the Sweden Democrats have been claiming that given their very large share of the vote now and the significant increase from the last election, that it would be undemocratic, quote unquote, not to give them more influence in policymaking.
So immigration was clearly a big issue, and while the Sweden Democrats did obviously, sound the alarm as much as they could, and it seems to have paid off somewhat for them, it's nevertheless, Sweden has the highest number of asylum seekers per capita, but it's still 160,000 out of a population of, what, about 10 million?
Well, the Sweden actually now has a higher percentage of foreign-born citizens than even the United States does. So it has the highest percentage of foreign-born citizens of any European country now, except for sort of the micro-states like, you know, Andorra or Monaco. And this is a country that a generation ago was fairly homogenous. The largest rate of change happened during the refugee crisis of 2015 to 2016, when the country did take in 160,000 refugees, which is proportionately twice the number that Germany took in. And we all know about the pictures of Merkel and Germans taking in really large numbers of refugees. But the Swedes took in twice as much proportionately. But overall now, Sweden has almost 20% of its residents being foreign-born. So that is really a gargantuan change for a generation or so, in a country, again, that was homogenous up until, you know, a few decades ago.
So you're quoted as more or less saying that the Social Democrats simply did not come up with an alternative narrative, and that essentially the far right Swedish Democrats filled that void. I actually recently spoke with a Swedish journalist who's obviously a supporter of the Social Democrats, as had been the tradition, if you will, in Sweden. And she was saying that, you know, when she would go to work, for example, leaving her apartment, there's a little sort of wooded area between her apartment and the bus stop. And, you know, she's walking to the bus stop early one morning and there's a Roma family that have camped there, and the father is relieving himself right in front of her. And she expressed a great deal of discomfort just in general, the sort of cultural clash, if you will. It wasn't so much, Syrians or Afghans, but in this case, Roma, which, of course, you know, have been badly mistreated in Hungary. So is there a sense of denial? Has political correctness hobbled the Social Democrats from really, you know, rather than capitalizing and demagoguing an issue, trying to solve it?
Well, look, I think that what has happened is that for a variety of reasons, I don't know if I would call it political correctness. It may just have been an assumption on the part of generally sort of cosmopolitan and tolerant elites that these problems could be solved. And in fact, if you look at the data, Sweden has actually made remarkable progress integrating immigrants increasingly into the labor market, raising educational levels, and on a whole variety of other practical measures. But the scale of the challenge is simply immense. As I said, the demographic change is unprecedented, not just for Sweden, but even for other European countries. And so I think a combination of not fully recognizing how immense the practical challenges would be. Most of the immigrants are not educated doctors and lawyers. They're people fleeing conflicts with very low education levels, very different cultural backgrounds, very little skills that would enable them to integrate easily into the Swedish labor market. So there was a large practical challenge that I think may have been underestimated. And I also think there's a general tradition of cosmopolitanism and tolerance. And so I think a lot of the leaders just assumed that, again, things would take care of themselves. And they sort of left the field too much to the Sweden Democrats to define the narrative, not only on immigration in particular, but on connecting immigration to other problems that Sweden faces with its welfare state and other kinds of social policy problems. And so, you know, a whole variety of things came together, I think, to kind of sideswipe the Social Democrats and work to the advantage of the populist Sweden Democrats.
So could the Social Democrats have made the argument that we don't so much have a migration crisis as an integration crisis?
Yeah, Yes, and I think, in fact, that is the general sense, actually, on the part of most Swedes. So if you look at survey data, Swedes still come out as the least racist, least nationalistic people in Europe. Their concerns when they talk about immigration have to do with quite practical things like assimilation, like protecting the welfare state, like making sure that everybody works and everybody contributes to the tax base and things of that nature. So I think what should have been done was a greater stress been placed on the incredible accomplishments of Sweden over the past years. The economy is in general doing very well. And again, it has absorbed an immense number of new immigrants without the kind of social upheaval you might have expected, and build on those already significant successes to talk about how the strong Swedish state and the strong Swedish model was going to be able to integrate all of these new citizens into Swedish society, into the Swedish labor market, into Swedish values. But again, I think that the problem was not perhaps fully thought through, and so it was left to the Sweden Democrats too much to define the conversation. And so it ended up being about crime, it ended up being about terrorism, it ended up being about failed immigration and a whole variety of other negative things, rather than a focus on the positive accomplishments Sweden has actually achieved.
And there was a car or truck, I think it was used as a murder weapon, which we've seen, unfortunately, all too often in Europe, in Sweden, in a shopping mall area. I believe it was an Uzbek who mowed down a bunch of people. And I'm in terms of the overall statistics, though, there have only 113 murders last year out of a population of nearly 10 million. I think almost that many are killed in Chicago over a weekend. So I mean, I've become addicted to Swedish mysteries and dramas on television, and Wallander and all these others. It seems like they have the greatest crime writers in the world, but does that exaggerate the murder rate, which is incredibly low?
Yes, I think there are many more crimes in Swedish novels than there are in Sweden. If you look at the statistics, crime in Sweden overall has gone down. This is also true of Germany. However, what has now unfortunately happened in Sweden is that many migrants have become concentrated in areas where they predominate, where there's, again, large amounts of unemployment, large amounts of people who don't speak Swedish, large amounts of people with low education levels. And so these areas have had rises in all kinds of crimes. So, for instance, there was recently in the news a very terrible case of some bombing of some cars in Sweden. This didn't take place in central Stockholm. This took place in a very poor immigrant neighborhood. Now, that doesn't make it better, but the crime that has occurred has generally been concentrated in certain areas. It's not an overall rise in the crime rate. So while it's definitely a real problem, and ghettos or, you know, concentrated enclaves of poor people or people who are not well integrated in society, that is definitely a social problem. But it's important to recognize what exactly the problem is so that you can solve it. So again, there has been crime, there has been terrorism. Has it been a gigantic wave of either of these things? Absolutely not. Again, that does not mean it isn't problematic and needs to be taken care of, but a few spectacular pictures definitely can stick in people's minds and blind them to what the sort of more general reality actually is.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, back to the stalemate in terms of not being able to form a government, or at least the numbers are pretty close. What's your prediction? Do you see political paralysis or some kind of solution happening soon?
Well, look, Sweden had a minority government before the election. You can and have had minority governments in Sweden. It has the kind of system where, in fact, a government can come to power with a minority of the vote. The problem with minority governments, as you might suspect, is that they tend to be weak and they tend to be vulnerable. So if Sweden wants to deal with the actual problems, it does have a strong government able to pass significant policy reforms through parliament would be necessary. That looks unlikely. Again, the most probable outcomes are either another minority government of the left or a minority government of the center-right that relies on the Sweden Democrats to pass certain policies. And they will, again, the price that the center-right would have to pay for that is much stricter immigration policies, and probably a lack of the kinds of reforms to the welfare state that would actually make it more responsive and make it more efficient. The Sweden Democrats' response to the welfare state problems is to just chop off immigrants' ability access to social policy and to limit the number of immigrations, but to limit the number of immigrants, rather. But that's not going to solve the problems.
Well, your statistic, though, 20% of the population being foreign-born is pretty extraordinary. And that's something that definitely is stuck in my mind. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it, Sherry Berman.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Sherry Berman, who's a professor of political science at Barnard College of Columbia University, whose research interests include European history and politics, the development of democracy, populism and fascism, and the history of the left. Her forthcoming book is Democracy and Dictatorship from the Ancien Regime to the Present Day. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into how Trump has basically told the Palestinians it's my way or the highway. وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فقدت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق امنيتك رصد السيارة وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فكرت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق امنيتك انسرقنا من ارضنا بلدنا انغلبنا عحالنا انقلبنا اقنعونا وتدربنا نحمي اسرائيل من حالنا صرنا ممسوكين عساكر وين ما كان بس اللي يقول هاد لمين وين 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 الملايين وين الملايين اللي بدنا تحرر فلسطين. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Halid El-Gindi, who's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Obama. Welcome to Background Briefing, Halid El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
And it would seem that since you've written about the history of America and Palestinians from Balfour to Obama, the latest chapter, the Trump chapter, seems to be a major departure, in as much as I can't imagine that any Palestinian thinks that the U.S. is even-handed now with Jared Kushner and Trump's ambassador, the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem, and with Sheldon Adelson essentially appointing or being the guy behind the appointment of John Bolton. It's so stacked in Israel's favor that it's something of a joke, isn't it?
I would say, first of all, just a quick update. The book is now entitled From Balfour to Trump, so it does include a discussion of the Trump administration and his impact on the situation. But to answer your question, the United States, I don't think Palestinians ever expected that the United States would be an even-handed broker. But they did expect the United States to be at least an effective broker, and that is that they would at least put enough pressure on Israel at key moments and on key issues, when the situation required, on Jerusalem, on Palestinian statehood, that when all was said and done, even though the United States clearly cannot be considered an even-handed broker, they would at least do what was minimally possible to get Israel to, for example, end its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. But what we've seen is, first, I would say, a deterioration of that expectation. There's been an erosion in the U.S. position over the past 25 years or more. And that is kind of culminating really in this, in the Trump phenomenon. So Trump is really, in a sense, the most extreme manifestation of a process that we've seen under previous administrations, both Republican and Democrat.
Well, but isn't the basic, could you sum up the Trump attitude to the Palestinian negotiations and this idea that they have a new plan and somehow because the Palestinians aren't negotiating with them, they're punishing the Palestinians by closing the Palestinian Liberation Office's mission in Washington, which has been there since 1994. To sum it up, isn't the Trump administration's attitude to the Palestinians, it's my way or the highway?
I would say that this administration is in virtually 100% lockstep with the current Israeli government. And even though past administrations have always favored Israel, there's been enormous amount of deference to Israeli narratives and priorities and demands, as I said, both Republican and Democratic presidents, this administration doesn't even make a pretense toward trying to be somewhat fair or balanced. It has completely adopted the most extreme Israeli positions on Jerusalem, the decision to move the embassy and recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and to cut Palestinian aid to the Palestinians, to cut off aid to the UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees, which is unprecedented in 70 years of U.S. policy. So this administration has reversed all of these decisions and official policies essentially to bring American policy in line with where the current Israeli government is. And in that sense, it is new. It's new in terms of the degree to which there is no daylight between this administration and what is essentially a very right-wing, hardline government in Israel.
And again, I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, who's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. So what about, though, the broader, if you will, landscape there in the Middle East, the change that's underway because of the hostility between Saudi Arabia and Iran and the extent to which both Netanyahu and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, seem to be trying to goad the U.S. into getting into a war on their behalf to take down the Iranian regime? My understanding is that that's changed the entire calculus in terms of the Sunni Arab regimes because of the hostility towards Iran. In other words, previously Saudi Arabians and others would say to the Americans, you know, or the Israelis, you know, we want to help you make a deal with the Palestinians, a final settlement, and that's always going to be a precondition for any relationships we have with you. They always made the Palestinian issue a precondition for negotiations. Well, now the Saudis and the Israelis sort of and the Egyptian military government seem to have a de facto alliance, and the Palestinian issue is no longer a precondition. It's not. It seems almost like an afterthought now.
It's true. There is a kind of convergence of interests between Arab Gulf states like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And Israel, particularly with regard to their common enemy, Iran. And as you know, and as probably most of your listeners know, the whole region is in turmoil and has been for the past several years. And the Palestinian issue has gotten pushed to the back burner. The crisis in Syria, the war in Yemen, the focus on Iran all have essentially trumped the Palestinian question, which has traditionally been a priority for key Arab states like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and it's no longer that. And that is part of the dilemma that this current Palestinian leadership faces, in that it's not only trying to confront the Israeli occupation and a U.S. administration that is more or less in lockstep with Israeli policy, but also an indifferent or apathetic regional environment is also not helping. And I would add that the fact that Palestinians themselves are divided also doesn't help matters. So, you know, we have essentially a situation where Israel is trying to impose officially by having the United States adopt its policies to impose a solution on the weaker party, on the Palestinians, in the expectation that they will be too weak to resist. Their traditional regional allies aren't there for them, and their leadership is divided. And so this is, I think Palestinians will see this as an attempt to impose the status quo more or less indefinitely on the Palestinians.
So along with, I mentioned earlier that Sheldon Adelson, the casino billionaire, who is behind the free newspaper in Israel that's basically a promotional campaign for Netanyahu, he has a lot of influence here. I think he's the second biggest donor, if not the biggest donor, to the Trump election, along with the Mercers. And it's pretty clear that Sheldon Adelson weighed in and made sure that John Bolton became the national security advisor. And now Bolton, of course, is not just, well, the State Department is closing down the PLO office in Washington, but Bolton is also going after the International Criminal Court. Not that the U.S. has ever signed on to that, but he's going after U.S. judges and people who participate in that court. That seems to me to be something of a lawless witch hunt. How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, it's in a sense par for the course for this administration. You know, it's a very heavy-handed approach to, you know, it's not a very subtle or nuanced attempt to pursue its priorities. It's really pretty ham-handed, and essentially trying to bully international forums into abiding by its own set of priorities, which are not necessarily in the U.S. interest. You know, the United States is, you know, part of the calculation is that this administration, there is a trend within the Republican Party that is very anti-globalization, that is that is against international forums like the United Nations, part of the reason for cutting off, you know, it was like a two-for-one deal when the United States cut off funds to the UN agency UNRWA that provides assistance to Palestinian refugees. That was like a two-for-one deal because on the one hand, it is against Palestinians, which is red meat for Trump's political base, but also going after a UN agency, which is another issue that conservatives and hardline right wingers have they have issues with the whole international infrastructure, UN agencies and other international bodies. So, the ICC is yet another one of these international bodies that this administration is ideologically opposed to. And so it's an easy target. But again, it's done in a very heavy-handed way without real consideration for how it affects U.S. national interests. But that's been true all along. From the moment that Trump decided to move the embassy to Jerusalem and to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That went against, longstanding State Department opinion and the views of the intelligence community that had opposed it, as not only because Palestinians or the Arab world opposed it, but because it undermined U.S. credibility as a broker. But what we're seeing from this administration really is these decisions are being made purely on the basis of ideological disposition and domestic politics, without any consideration for, never mind the rule of law, but without any consideration for U.S. national interest.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, when you talk about domestic considerations in terms of what Trump is doing and Jared Kushner and all these pro-Israel people that they put in there in key positions, what they're pandering to, and certainly what Trump is pandering to, is the base of the Republican Party, the Christian Zionist base, if you will. I mean, that is such a sick perversion of theology. It's almost theological pornography, the idea that all of these born-again Christians who don't even believe in the Bible except for the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation, which they're obsessed with. And the idea is that they love Israel because Israel triggers Armageddon, that triggers the end of the world, and people like you and me die in the consumed by fire in the lake of fire. So our lives end in burning flesh in order for these good Christians to be raptured up and to be born again. So it's not a good deal for Israel. So the whole thing, I find it really obscene. But that is at the heart of the support that Trump's base has for Israel.
I think it's true that obviously a big, an important part of his political base are evangelical Christians, or what you might call Christian Zionists. And, you know, without getting into the theology of their beliefs, you know, what's clear is that they are very strongly pro-Israel, and not just to support, you know, most Americans support Israel's security and continued existence and so on, but this is a constituency that wants to see, that believes in greater Israel, that Israel has a right to the occupied territories, a divine right, that these are biblical lands that belong solely to the Jews, and that Palestinians have no place there, and certainly shouldn't be sovereign over these, you know, what is the biblical birthright of the Jewish people. So that is, that's clearly a factor in a very, you know, obviously important factor in what Trump, in his decision making. But it's not a view that is held by the majority of Americans. So what we, you know, we have a president who is catering to really the fringe of the fringe in terms of, you know, his political base. And again, without any real consideration for how it affects the United States and its national interests, much less how it affects ordinary Palestinians and Israelis.
Well, Khaled El-Ghindi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Khaled El-Ghindi, who's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with former White House cyber czar Richard Clark on Russian meddling in the upcoming election.
Burning Isaac, Jesus coming. Jesus comes to pave the way. Do you believe in his sweet sensation? Do you believe? second chance. Do you believe in rapture?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Richard Clark, the CEO of Good Harbor Security Risk Management, which advises companies and governments on cybersecurity. He served for 30 years in the U.S. government, including 10 continuous years as a White House official, serving three consecutive presidents as Special Assistant to the President for Global Affairs, National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism, and Special Advisor to the President for Cyberspace. The author of 8 books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. His most recent book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. And he is the host of a new podcast, Future State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Clark.
Yeah, good to be with you.
And Richard Clark, since you've served in three administrations, both Democratic and Republican, and been a professional on the National Security Council, both in terms of counterterrorism and cybersecurity. If you were in the Trump White House today, would you have written that op-ed piece in the New York Times that's caused so much controversy?
No, I wouldn't. I think two observations. First, it is natural for career civil servants to resist the whims of presidents and to try to slow roll some of their initiatives. That's natural. It's unusual for political appointees to do that. Second observation is there comes a time when you have to quit and go public with your concerns. If you're ordered to do something that's illegal, if you're ordered to do something that's immoral, then I think you have an obligation to quit. But you have to remember that everybody takes an oath before they can serve, and it's an oath not to the president, but to the Constitution. And so when you're being told to do things that would damage the country, I think it's a natural reaction to not do them.
So you mentioned that in terms of setting up this new podcast that you're hosting starting today, Future State, and I take it it's a continuum of the idea that you were a sort of sentinel in your job on the National Security Council to look ahead. And that's why 9/11 was so important in the sense that some people predicted it and others ignored that information. But in saying that we need to be focusing on cyber war, terrorism, nuclear weapons, climate change, and the future of work in America in this election year or these election months, you're suggesting that we shouldn't get lost in the Trump show. Just talking about the op-ed, in a sense, in the New York Times is getting lost in the Trump show, in as much as what's happened is with Trump basically conducting what I call government by stunt on a daily basis, the press is not focusing on the contents of that op-ed, but rather on who possibly wrote it.
That's right. And what I'm trying to do with the Future State podcast is not talk about what you're seeing on the cable news, but talk about issues that people should be thinking about and should be discussing. What is the future of work? What is the risk, continuing risk, if there is one, of terrorism? Why are we about to spend $1 trillion on new nuclear weapons? What's the risk of climate change? Those are things that you would normally talk about. You'd look forward at the new risks, the new threats. You'd want candidates to talk about that sort of thing under normal circumstances. And the Trump show drowns all of that out. I'm not saying don't talk about Trump, because we have to. We have to get rid of this guy somehow. So we do have to talk about him.
But it shouldn't be the only thing we talk about. We still have to worry about the substance, about the issues.
So what worries me is that we don't know what went on in that secret meeting between Trump and Putin in Helsinki. We certainly saw the aftermath at the press conference where the president of the United States, in front of the eyes of the world, essentially sided with Putin over whether he meddled in our elections. He, of course, denied it, and Trump basically accepted that denial in front of the cameras and then later had that kind of lame, you know, my dog ate my homework excuse that I meant to say wouldn't or would have, you know. So we don't know what went on prior to that press conference. The press conference itself was alarming enough. And frankly, I think John Brennan is correct in suggesting that there may have been a line crossed there in terms of treason, because on January the 6th of 2017, a couple of weeks before Trump was inaugurated, all the heads of intelligence briefed him and gave him absolutely unequivocal information about the extent of Russian interference in our elections, and yet he chose to ignore that. Any commander-in-chief in that situation in our history would have turned to Putin and said, yes, you did it, and don't do it again. So let's focus on that for a minute. Do you think this president could be engaged in some kind of treasonous activity short of the traditional legal definition of treason?
Well, I don't know what was said. That's the problem. None of us know what was said. Some people have suggested to me that maybe that was a way of him, a way of Trump getting new orders, getting his orders updated, getting new guidance from the boss. The problem is we don't know. And so rumors like that and assumptions like that are allowed to propagate. And they're terrible rumors and terrible assumptions, but we have no way of knowing whether or not they're true. I think if you look at the Steele dossier, that the British intelligence officer who, during the 2016 election, put together all of this information about Trump and Russia, 99% of that has been corroborated. And that's very disturbing. I think there is something that the Russians have on Trump. I think it probably has to do with money laundering through his company. I'm hoping Bob Mueller will find that and prove it.
Well, but without being paranoid or indulging in conspiracy theories, the fact that that was a secret meeting leads to the, I think, the very real possibility that since Putin interfered in the last election to elect Trump or help elect him, it's not inconceivable that we know that Trump is really paranoid about the Democrats taking the House. And
for good reason.
For good reason, because then they start investigating, which is really what's, I think, the crying shame of what's happening to the United States at the moment, that we don't have a separation of powers because the legislative branch is not acting as a check and balance on the executive branch. And that will certainly happen if the Democrats take the House. But to my mind, it's not inconceivable that in that private meeting, Trump said, look, you helped me out in 2016, but I really need your help, Vladimir, in November, because this Democratic blue wave is going to probably sweep the Republicans out of the House, and then they'll start investigating me and they'll impeach me. So
I don't think Trump even has to ask for the Russians' help. I think they know that this situation is occurring, and we know for a fact that many of the troll identities that they were using in 2016 are back. You know, they go on Twitter, and they change the name that they're using, but you can still tell it's the same source. And we know they're active, and they're doing a whole series of things to cause division in our country. They're pretending to be African Americans and saying blacks should not vote. They're pretending to be environmentalists. And they're saying people should vote for the Green Party. It's not a wasted vote, you know, even though it obviously is. They're assuming all sorts of different identities, not just to promote Republicans, not just to promote Trump and his allies, but also just to whip up hate and dissension here in the United States.
Well, but you also could be describing Fox News in a sense, because the Russians call them political technologists, but This character, Surkov, a theater director who became Putin's media advisor and has basically created this alternative universe where facts don't matter, that nothing is true and everything is possible, that's sort of migrated here to the United States. And if 30% of the country wasn't locked inside the bubble of delusion that Fox and Breitbart and Sinclair propagate, Trump would, I think that would be, he'd be on his way out totally, as opposed to hanging on and pandering to that constituency. So do you see any similarities there in this Orwellian sense that we have, you know, when you got people like Kellyanne Conway, the White House counsel, talking about alternative facts?
How well, you see these themes pop up, and they're picked up by Fox News. They're picked up by Breitbart. They're also picked up by the Russian outlets like RT and Sputnik. And they're picked up by all the Russian troll identities. And it's difficult to know from one theme to another where they first appeared, because they have a remarkable tendency to appear simultaneously, it seems, on both the Russian outlets, the Russian trolls and fake identities, and Fox News and Breitbart all at the same time.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Clark, CEO of Good Harbor Security Risk Management, which advises companies and governments on cybersecurity. He served for 30 years in the United States government, including 10 continuous years as a White House official, serving three consecutive presidents, a special assistant to the president for global affairs, national coordinator for security and counterterrorism, and special advisor to the president for cyberspace. The author of 8 books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. His most recent book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. And he's the host of the new podcast, Future State. But in your previous job, after you was head of counterintelligence on the National Security Council, Richard Clark, you became the cyber czar, for the want of a better description. Back to that question, though, we don't know what went on in that secret meeting in Helsinki between Putin and Trump, but we do know that the Russians made explorations in the last election cycle in 2016 into voting rolls and into state election systems, many of which aren't secure at all, particularly in Georgia, where you have a Secretary of State who himself doesn't appear to believe in democracy and is quite capable of rigging the results on these electronic machines, which he did in terms of the John Ossoff race down there in that first important special election that could have been a bellwether for Trump's support. What's your understanding of how vulnerable we are to either election rolls being hacked or the results themselves in this midterm being hacked?
Well, you have three different things that can be hacked. You have the campaign organizations themselves. Some of them are independent, some of them are party organizations, but they're notoriously vulnerable because they just don't have enough money for cybersecurity. It turns out really securing a network is expensive. The second thing you have that can be hacked are the voting rolls, so that when someone shows up to vote, they're not on the list, or they have to go to another location. And many of those people will just say, to hell with it at that point. Or it'll make the lines very long in certain locations. If you know the Democrats are going to do well in that precinct, you make the lines very long there, and people will eventually go home if they're having to stand out in the rain. The third thing that you can hack, of course, are the machines themselves, and that turns out to be notoriously easy if you have access. Now, and getting the access is difficult. But there are three different things. And what we've learned is the Russians have tried to do hacking into campaigns, succeeded in the case of the Clintons. They've tried to hack into the voting lists. We don't know that they've tried to go after the machines, but here's the thing that I would point out. We don't know the extent of what they've done. We only know what people have caught. And most of the time when a Russian state organization tries to hack into something, they do it so well that they don't get caught. So when people say, oh, there's no evidence that this happened, yeah, well, of course not. There wouldn't be evidence because they're really good at it. When the United States government does it, there's no evidence.
Well, conversely, of course, the Skripal attack with Novichok in Salisbury in the UK looked as though, with the GRU's fingerprints on it, that Putin was actually sending a signal that he wanted to get caught,
Absolutely. That was about deterrence.
Right.
That was a message to anybody who's thinking about, any Russian who's thinking about being a spy for the West. That was the message, we have a long arm. Wherever you are, we'll get you and we'll kill you.
So tell me about the new podcast. Your first guest is Bill Clinton. That's today, right?
The first one is, there are two available today. One is with Bill Clinton. The second one, which we did for 9/11, is with the former head of the National Counterterrorism Center, Nick Rasmussen.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Sheehan, who was held five or six prominent counterterrorism jobs in the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department. After we taped that, Michael Sheehan died. He'd been fighting a cancer, and this was his last interview. And it's a very powerful interview. It talks about the fact that the terrorism threat is moribund, but not yet completely removed, and it could come back. And we're not saying it will come back. We're not trying to scare people. I think it's a very level-headed discussion for about an hour. But it sounds like three counterterrorism people talking in a way that it sounds like you're in a room in the White House listening to them. It doesn't sound like an interview. It doesn't sound like something that was meant to be public. It sounds like three professionals talking about the issue.
And in terms of terrorism, though, I would link it in a way to going back to Putin. I don't mean to obsess on him, and I get lots of letters from listeners saying that I'm obsessed with Russia, but I don't believe there's ever been anything like this. The very possibility that the President of the United States could be an asset of the leader in the Kremlin is the most extraordinary, if it's true, it'd be the most extraordinary intelligence operation since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar in 1917 and sent him to Russia. So that's my justification for keeping an eye on Putin. But I see a link here in terms of what's happening in Western Europe, where one or two terrorist acts can change elections, as we've just seen in Sweden. Last time when Putin intervened in Syria, shortly thereafter was the major exodus of refugees into Europe. Now they have Idlib surrounded and they're about to pound that place into submission. 3 million refugees could flood into Turkey and on into Europe. And last time it happened, the SACEUR, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, referred to what Putin was doing as was weaponizing refugees. So that seems to me to be a strategy that he's used and he may use again to weaken Western Europe. What's our strategy?
Well, we don't have one. The United States is not a player in what's going on in Turkey, in Syria. You know, we still have 2,000 troops in and around Syria. But if you look at the last two diplomatic conferences, summits, the president of Russia, the president of Turkey, the president of Iran, they're the ones who are sitting around the table deciding what's going to happen. There's no American at that table.
So how are we going to get through, then, this period where you have this almost theater of the absurd with President Trump? He's swapping kind of love letters via tweet with Kim Jong-un. He had this absolutely fatuous and meaningless photo op down in Singapore. It's obvious that it's going nowhere. He wants to meet with Putin. None of the real stuff's being dealt with. Where are these so-called adults in the room? Are they just not in a position that we've never had a situation before where we have a president who himself is very likely to be a threat to America's national security?
This reminds me of the period when Richard Nixon was on the ropes, the last days of Richard Nixon, when he was hitting the bottle, his alcoholism was rampant, and his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, and the Secretary of Defense, Jim Schlesinger, were running the national security show, including the Middle East war that was going on in 1973, essentially without talking to the president, because they were afraid to. I don't think we've had anything like it in my lifetime except for that. It's almost the Manchurian Candidate, if you saw the original movie, where the leader could, in fact, be under control, could be a controlled asset of a foreign government. I don't know that that's true, but I think it's a reasonable suspicion, and that's pretty awful.
Right, but the difference with Nixon was he was probably one of the most competent presidents we've ever had and most experienced.
When he was sober and when when his paranoia was under control.
Right. But in terms of foreign policy, it's true. He was having a bad day when Watergate was happening. But this guy, out of the gate, he has no qualifications. He has no understanding. Woodward's book indicates that Secretary of Defense Mattis feels it's like talking to a fifth or sixth grader.
Well, so Mattis and, to some extent, Pompeo, now at State, try to maneuver around him. It's not so much that they're disobeying orders. It's that they're doing things without reference to him, and they're hiding things from him. But there is no national security process. I was always big on process, that issues should be identified, issues should be analyzed, evidence should be presented, options should be created, options should be compared one to the other, and then the president should have the benefit of all of that, transparent process. None of that happens now.
Well, just in closing, I don't want to depress our audience. I certainly, myself, on a daily basis, I feel I'm dispensing the daily dose of doom just covering Donald Trump. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, I think there is. And I felt very, watching the John McCain memorial at National Cathedral, I felt uplifted. That the church was filled with great Americans, all of whom want to have nothing to do with Donald Trump. And people talked about what this country has been, what this country is, what this country can be again. I think this could be a passing disaster, like a hurricane going through a city. I hope that's the case. But for that to be the case, people have to get out and vote in November.
Well, on that note, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Clark.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Clark, CEO of Good Harbor Security Risk Management, which advises companies and governments on cybersecurity. He served for 30 years in the United States government, including 10 continuous years as a White House official, serving three consecutive presidents as Special Assistant to the President for Global Affairs, National Coordinator for Security and Counterterrorism, and Special Advisor to the President for Cyberspace. The author of 8 books, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror. His most recent book is Warnings, Finding Cassandras to Prevent Catastrophes. And he is the host of the new podcast, Future State. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.